because you only get tested maybe at this level once in 4 years, you know what I mean? You got a balls to kick them.
So England in possession, and that much of this ball.
And it kicks it away again.
Toby Flood.
Don't sink!
This is not soccer. This is not soccer.
Because in either game, life or rugby, the margin for error is so small.
Welcome again to an Examiner Sport podcast special and the second part of our exclusive chat with Munster Rugby's now retired first CEO, Gareth Fitzgerald. Part one finished on the financial imperatives or not of European success, but before there was a Heineken Cup, Munster were making world headlines with their victories over touring sides, including 1992 in Cork against the Wallabies, when Gareth Fitzgerald was head coach. In this segment, we discuss Munster's best and not-so-good signings, the reputed disconnect with the clubs in Munster in the professional era, the controversial Gerbrand Grobler signing, and the tragic loss of a Munster legend in Axel Foley. Here's part two, and thank you for tuning in. We'd appreciate your constructive comments. What were you like as a head coach the day in 1992 when ye beat the Wallabies in Musgrave Park? I mean, as I said earlier, I remember interviewing Bob Dwyer afterwards and he was not happy with Munster. But can you remember that day? Can you remember how you managed that day?
I can't remember it really. I remember like going to, for me, as an individual who had never played for Munster, to be given an opportunity to coach Munster was a huge honour. That wasn't my first year doing it. I did it previous years and we'd been reasonably successful to coach against a touring side with the reputation that Munster had against touring sides. There was an expectation of a performance. I remember it's kind of an intimidating atmosphere that you're playing against a side who had won the World Cup or with Bob Dwyer and you're coming along, he's your opposite number. You're sitting in the timber seats in the stand in Musgrave Park. You don't know whether they're going to fall down or whether they're going to break under or what's going to happen. And as I said, to a certain extent, it's nearly bicycle clip country, you know. You're fucking wondering what's going to happen.
Are you going to lose 43-0?
Yeah,
is that
exactly
the thing you're worried about?
Yeah. With the assistance of a lot of other people and things like that, we had studied. We'd studied Australia on all their European tour, and we were doing a huge amount of video analysis with the help of Stephen Aboud, who was working for the IRFU at the time, and we had spent 2 months studying Australia to see how we could beat them.
Right.
And the first conclusion we came to, now if we try and play rugby against them, we'd definitely lose. Right, or if we base it totally on rugby.
Yeah.
So in the team selection, we picked the team to dominate their pack. There was fellas got picked that day. Never thought they'd get picked for Munster. But the team was picked that way. And we tried to mix it with the football brain and the physical side of the game. And it, luckily enough for us, worked. It was Bob Dwyer obviously knew Peter Clahasy from his time when Peter played in Australia when he was suspended in Europe.
Right.
And the fact that we got to push
over. See, there's a whole generation now of people who will listen to this, Gareth, won't even know that.
Yeah, well, Peter had got suspended for, I think, an incident at an Ireland-France game, if I'm correct. And what he was allowed play in the Southern Hemisphere, if I'm correct. And he went and he played for Queensland, I think. Right. Where he played rugby in Australia for a bit of Bob. And Peter was technically as good as any prop there was around. He was a tough, hard man who was a small man physically. I was afraid of nothing, and I listened to that. And in the front row with him that day was Terry Kingston and Paul McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And so we managed to dominate him a bit up front. David Nusafora was captain that day for Australia playing hooker.
Correct.
And our motto for the day was don't let them play. That was it. If we let them play, we're goosed.
Mm.
And take our chances when they came. And we had a lot of very good players like Brian Walsh and Jack Clark and Philip Danaher and different people like that. Channing Charlie Halley was full back.
Mm.
And Dan Larkin was playing, started out half. And Dan was a very underrated rugby player, a great rugby brain, a man ahead of his time, really. I think Dan was the one fellow who told me, he said, you're off your head. He said, if we play the way you want to play, we've no chance. But he was probably right, but it worked out. It worked out. It was a very intimidating day. Like, I was still only young as a coach then, and dealing at that level, which was a big step up up for me at that time. And I remember Bob Dwyer shouting and roaring in the stand, shouting at Clancy, and he was one of them taken off the field and one of them sent off. And I think the post-match dinner was in the old Jury's Hotel in the Western Road at that stage, and I even shook hands with him and everything. So he told me he didn't want to talk. He said, look, he said, I'm too mad, I can't talk to you, I'll talk to you later. And all that was that.
This was even that night he had
Yeah, but he was
down.
Very nice about it, but he said this shouldn't have happened. You know, he reckoned that we had roughed him up over beyond the limits of the law.
Boot, bite, bollock, yeah. As you say. Yeah.
But no, we had a lot of good players playing that way. We just played that day. But it was for Munster to beat a touring side, it was a continuation of a tradition that was there. Mm. We did a lot of very good players. They didn't have all their first team playing, but it was a huge achievement for us. And everything else like that, and I could say we probably enjoyed it for a few days after it.
Yeah,
things like that, you know. But Mick Galway was sent off that day with one of their locks. I can't remember the fella's name if you said it, but they were all different things that happened in it. And Jim Galvin came on as a sub, and another time to see dropped a goal to win it in the end.
Yeah, that's correct. Famous name
off one of their lineouts. I think they're Ben Cronin robbed. If I'm correct, I think.
I'm right in thinking, what year was it, Gareth, that you beat Australia? I remember actually, I was out of the country, I watched it. It was a horrible night in Thomond Park. Is that around 2012? Do you remember that game?
I do. That
played
was appalling, yeah.
Appalling rain.
I remember there was a guy sitting on the bench for Australia that night who shall be nameless that we were having contract negotiations with.
Right.
I met him afterwards and downstairs. He said, forget it, mate, not fucking here.
Really? God, my head is really bad. And I know that there was a second draw that day played for Munster, Nagel.
Ian Nagel, who I thought
was really good.
He got men in the match then.
Yeah, I thought he was going to go on and be. And I mean, it just goes to show it doesn't, for, you know, we talk again about individual. It doesn't always work out.
No. Same in a lot of sports, doesn't always work out.
What year was it there? I'm actually just even looking at the notes in it here. It was 2012. It was 15-6, 2012.
Yeah, that was an appalling night. It was no one. No one enjoyed that night on the pitch, you know, but
no,
it was still a result, you know.
It was, exactly. And just while we're just on the whole subject of success, you describe beautifully there the whole, you know, scene around 2006. Like, how much of a different emotional was it then, winning it 2 years later again against Toulouse? I mean, in the same stadium. But was it a, can you remember that occasion, Gareth? Do you remember the aftermath? Was it a very different kind of a, well, it
well,
was
it
more
was, I think, I suppose one of the things, when I got into the game and I was kind of new to it and there wasn't anyone else to bounce things off of, you're always looking for people that you set your markers against, you know. And Toulouse was a club that was at the top of things in Europe at that stage. And in fairness to Toulouse, they were always open to conversations or listening or asking them their opinions on things. And you meet some of them through European rugby, and we had exchanged a few thoughts and ideas. And I think we'd build up a bit of respect with Toulouse. So Toulouse to me, not at this stage as much, but I used to refer to Toulouse as the Real Madrid of rugby.
Yeah, and they were.
They were, you know. So when I look at 2000 at that, and I think it was in 2016, is it? I think Rob Penny was coach. We played him in a quarter-final in Thomond Park. And we beat them by, I wrote the score down there somewhere. We beat them by good, but then Axel was the forwards coach. And when I look at the results we got against Toulouse and in that final, that said to me, you know, we're as good as Toulouse, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas when I started out in the job, you were saying, oh my God, do we have to play Toulouse, you know, that sort of thing. But we'd reached a different category, and different height in people's opinion. So in the final, I suppose, having experienced one final and having experienced how you dealt with it and everything else like that, I think we were much more professional around it. But I think we were calmer. We were much calmer as well about it. Players were better about it. They knew their opposition better as well a couple of years later and all that.
Yeah.
And all that helps, you know. But it's still a final. You still have to win it, you know. It isn't about your reputation. Won't win anything for you.
No. And just going, you know, you mentioned about yourself, but even you talk about Declan, you talk about what Alan Gaffney brought, you talk about what Tony McGahan brought, even Rob Penny. I presume, and even right up to Razzie and Johan van Graan, I'm presuming that Munster has benefited of course, they've benefited for their CV, but you've been there, Gar, and I presume Munster have benefited enormously from their input. And their legacy has surely been something that you've actually been able to use for the betterment of Munster. Is that waffly or is that fact?
No, I think we've first of all, we've benefited from having international coaches involved. Like any work contractual situation, there'll be times where there'll be agreements and disagreements, but that's what I said, where respect in the workplace comes in. But our reputation abroad, I think, has benefited from all their inputs and what the input they're giving, having left Munster and gone elsewhere. They would have been hugely influential in players coming to Munster who would know them from previous coaching experience, who would ring up and say, what's this place like to go to?
Yeah.
That's been a huge benefit to us. Second of all, they've helped in recruiting players that we have that are good players.
Mm.
You know, having that contact, having coached them before, knowing it was younger players.
Well, can I just stop you there? Because one of the things that has always impressed me about the province is Munster's ability, certainly since 2000, to punch above its weight, if that's not too derogatory a term, in terms of the players that you've brought in. Now, I accept a lot of them were names, but do you think, looking back, that the likes of Williams and Langford were almost the forerunners to those, like, and what they brought to Munster and what they started?
Yeah, I think it was. It was a new process for everyone in Munster at that stage to be bringing in overseas players. John Langford was an exceptional individual again. We come back to it. Outside of his ability, he wasn't a top class international lock, but he was a top class individual with a great knowledge of the game and what you needed to be. The amount of the standards he set for fellas when he came was part of the reason why they were successful years later.
Yeah.
He said, you know, he set a standard that wasn't there beforehand. There's one other individual came in before him as well. Oh, I can't remember. He played with Shannon. He played in the centres. I'm terrible on name. I might think of it in a minute. Okay. You know, people like them. Jim Williams came a bit later, and Jim had been successful and played with Australia.
Yeah.
And it was known to people here because the rugby was getting a bit more coverage and had been seen to play. And they all brought something to the table in different ways and set different standards for people. And they were special people who added to the group that were already here, you know.
But like in terms of unearthing gems, because like, let's face it, your Christian Cullens and your Dougie Howlett's are established international names and it's great to get them. But when you look back in terms of, you know, was Langford one of those gems that you unearthed that actually became a lot more valuable, not just to Munster, but in terms of their philosophy going forward? Were there others?
Well, the thing is with John Langford, I think he came in partly as well to play with Shannon through a connection that Brian O'Brien had in Australia.
Mm.
And then he tipped over to the other side and something similar happened with Jason Holland. Jason came in to play with Middleton at the time, and that's how he ended up being called up to train with Munster, and how he ended up playing with Munster.
Mm. Pucciarello is the guy I remember.
Yeah, Federico was an exceptional guy. You know, he played with Bourgoin in France, but he was a character. You know, he was a guy who could play anywhere in the three positions in the front row. He was certainly an entertaining character. Still, he's a very successful businessman at home.
Yes,
presently.
Trevor Halstead is another name,
from South Africa. Yes, Trevor played in the final
and scored. Did he score a try in that 2006 final?
Yeah, Trevor Halstead. Like when you look at fellas like Laifimi Maffey, played in some of those finals. Laifimi was a guy who came in through a connection with who was our academy manager at the time, Hamish Adams, who came to Ireland initially to coach Dolph, with Dolphin.
Now with Athletics Ireland.
Athletics Ireland and all that. And he was from Hamish's home area. That's how he came in. I remember the first day he arrived as a young fella, his girlfriend came with him. We were looking for an apartment. I remember saying to the person, I don't know what school we're going to put her into. Like, they just were so young. They were kids, innocent kids who came. He was a huge asset, you know. He wasn't a top-class international player, but he achieved a huge amount with Munster, and he brought something to Munster that Munster fellas didn't have in stepping and feet and things like that, you know. There's lots of fellas like that.
And there's, just for every one of those, Gar, there's a few pluggers. There must have been ones, like every club. Every club gets them.
Everyone does at every level. If you're going to get your recruitment, if you're going to get 7 out of 10 in your recruitment, you'll get a star off your teacher on your forehead, you know, because you're good. But you have a much better chance of getting it right now because of analysis and because of the amount of coverage that's available on everyone.
Yes.
There was a time at the start where there was some blind. You were going on a telephone call from someone.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Oh, yeah. Going way back at the start. And you will have people like that. And I remember recruiting someone that came through a second-hand contact to come in to play with us. And he was meant, this individual was meant to be Christian Cullen's backup with Wellington. And he hadn't played with anybody, but he came and played with us, but we just got caught. Full stop.
Yes.
I remember having a walk around the pitch with the fella telling him that he was booked on a flight and just leaving at 4 o'clock tomorrow, and there you are, good luck, we'll see you, I'd collect you tomorrow and take you to the airport.
Because how long had he been in for?
I said, it's not working out for us and it's not working out for you, so the best thing we can do is agree. No.
Yeah.
And he did, and everyone was happy.
Did you find that any bit difficult, that side of the job?
Not really.
You're a hard bastard.
Well, you just have to be, if you're telling the truth all the time, you can't go too far wrong, you know? And
so is it a kind of a tap on the shoulder and this is...
Well, you'll get a bit of that. That's making a story out of it, you know? But the person themselves know. They know themselves.
Yeah.
They can't walk in amongst their peers if they're not delivering on a Saturday at some level or on Tuesday training.
Because when you hear conversations in pubs and who was Munster's worst ever signing... Yeah. I have a name in my head. I wouldn't libel the man by saying it, but without naming one, do you have one in your head? And how bad actually did you get it wrong?
You're pushing the boat a bit there now. You're just trying to make a name for yourself there, isn't it? Yeah.
That name. I have wrote it down. You have to put your glasses on to see it. How bad was he?
Yeah, we did recruit him.
I know you did.
Yeah.
And...
I would say not in any way as bad as portrayed by some people who use it as a source of a joke.
Right.
And anyway, but you're in the early days, you were basing it on a phone call. You didn't have anything from NPC Rugby in New Zealand. You had none of the provincial stuff.
No video.
You had nothing coming. So someone, you'd be ringing, talking to someone. They say, okay, we'll take a chance. And then if you get an agent who was persuasive and they sell you something that it doesn't look a bit what it looks like, it can happen and does it happen. It happens in football. You know, you ask United about Sanchez, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's human beings we're dealing with. They live and work in different cultures with different people. Some people it works out, for other people it doesn't. Some people become inhibited by the changes in their whole cultural movement and everything else like that. So you're definitely... Do we get stuff wrong? Yes.
Mm.
Will it be got wrong in the future? I would say yes, but to a much lesser extent because of the knowledge you now have of players, and you can see them 6 days a week on television if you want to.
Mm. The only downside of this interview, and this is not an interview, sorry, this chat, not going out live, is the fact that I could say to you right now that Munster have just signed Damien D'Alende, the South African centre, and played, I think, nearly every minute of every game. Hugely impressive. And it's just been confirmed that Munster have signed him. Now, obviously, this will be going out a week later, but you'd think to yourself, in terms of signings, that's as close to banker as you can get.
Yeah, well, he's a player that, going back a couple of years ago, we looked at.
Really?
And things like that, and you always have fellas like that. Well, there's not an awful lot of guys making top-class names for themselves as centres, you know, and things like that. And he's an impressive guy. He's a big, strong, impressive guy. He's just won a World Cup medal. Certainly a guy who would have been on the radar going back over the time. In recent times, I haven't been involved in anything like that, but obviously Johan knows him exceptionally well, and he would know all those players as people and as individuals, which is important before their playing ability.
Mm.
And I suppose, like a lot of the South Africans as well, you have, you know, just in the pure economics of it, you have a better chance of landing a South African than you do top class New Zealander or something like that. It doesn't mean there's any difference in capabilities between them or anything like that.
Yeah.
But that's great news for Munster if they have, or if they've just done that and signed. But I know that they were looking at a couple of positions and everything.
Tell me, going back, and again, we're on the subject of signings. Can you talk now about any of the ones that almost happened, but Munster just didn't quite get over the line? And there would have been, obviously, marquee, good signings, great signings for Munster, great signings for the player, but for one reason or another, didn't happen.
There's a lot of them fall into that category, but to be quite straight, there's none of them coming straight to mind on them. There's one or two people that would have fallen into that category that are still playing that I wouldn't talk about, to be fair to everyone's side on it.
Right.
I know there would always be a number of them at different levels you go through and things like that, and with the advent of major private investors in France and with the adverse of people coming back into England, some of those you couldn't compete with.
Yes.
But a lot of the players, you get some players who don't want to go to France because of the language issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You'd hope, Garrett, that you might have some players that are thinking, I'm not going to do this just for the money. This is a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, you get someone doing that. A lot of the Australians wouldn't want to come to Ireland weather-wise, and I'm not from Australia, and some of the times I wouldn't be coming here for the weather either.
Yeah.
But because it's not just the player; it's their partners and their families. The player is busy all day and they're doing things, but it's very difficult for. So the climate and language are an influence where some players would opt not to go because of that.
Mm. You mentioned there about coming to, as you say, the cities here and partners living here and there, which leads me on to that very delicate political issue of Cork and Limerick. It's one that obviously I've kind of been keeping, I suppose, something of an eye on over the last 15, 20 years. Obviously, Munster made the decision. And they had to make a decision, ultimately, Garrett, you know, to go one or the other. How difficult a decision was that? And how injurious in any way has it been to unity in the province?
If you're referring to about the training centre and all that, that decision was driven by, like, we laid out the requirements we were looking for in a training centre, and we spoke to a number of third level institutes who could have provided the facilities,
mm-hmm.
and were interested in providing, because we couldn't have done it ourselves. We needed to do it on a
partnership basis.
A partnership or a 15-year payment basis or lease basis with people. And we spoke to 4 to 5 different institutes who were interested in partaking in it. We had time frames. We had requirements and different things we were looking for, and they were all open to doing it, but when it came to giving an answer, when they could deliver it, or if they'd be able to deliver it, UL delivered and the others weren't able to deliver to the same extent or in the same time frame. And it was a decision that was driven by the availability of what we were looking for, given the fact that we had been working in conjunction with the University of Limerick on other aspects of the game, and an association we'd have had with Dave Mahidi, who was head of the whole fitness thing, that was a help. The most important thing is UL were really welcoming and wanted us to be there and did everything they could to help us to be there in a voluntary way. If we had ended up with any of the other partners, I think it would have worked the same. Because we would have seen it.
Even if they were in Cork?
Oh, yeah. The Cork limiting wasn't an issue. It was a matter of where we could get what we wanted. If it ended up in Killarney, so be it. You know, it was never a Cork Limerick issue.
Well, Garrett, it would be to people in Cork went to Limerick.
Oh, it is, yeah. But you'll always get people. I could go for a pint tonight on the way home and meet people talking about, they think they're totally informed and they haven't a clue what they're talking about. And they'll tell you about someone they met who told them, who never heard anything, you know.
Yeah.
And this still goes on today. And unfortunately, through social media, people believe everything they read or see, and 90% of it is uninformed. Mm. So honestly, there was no decision. The other thing to remember is when you're in professional sport and with Munster, it doesn't matter where you train. It makes no difference whether you train in Limerick, Tipperary or Clonmel or Killarney. It's how you play on Saturdays, all that matters.
That's true.
So We would have trained in Cork. We would have trained in Limerick. We would have trained in Mallow. We would have trained in Yall. But no one knew any of that. But suddenly they all became experts when they decided that a decision was taken.
Well, it's ownership, isn't it, though? I mean, it's ownership of the team. And, you know, we've already spoken about how there was this bond between the support because they felt, you know, there was an ownership of what Munster was about. And I suppose people in Cork felt, well, you know, our team has actually almost been uprooted and taken away from us. And if it was the other way around, I'm pretty sure the Limerick people...
But most of them probably didn't know where the team were training before they decided on that.
Well, that's... Yeah.
So it was... It never became an issue. It wasn't an issue with management, with players or with anything. Of course, when you make a decision like that, it becomes... A point of discussion.
Mm.
It has greatly helped the performance of our people. It has settled the thing. It's driven higher standards. So, but that could have happened in Limerick or Cork or elsewhere. For the people involved in the organisation, for the players, it was never anything like it was for other people.
And in fairness to you, over the years I've known you, you've always been really good and helpful. And I mean that genuinely in terms of clarifying stuff. Because we'd hear this stuff and I'd ring you and I'd say, Garrett, is this true?
No.
And I ask you no, because what you hear as well is, oh, well, there are players in the academy now and they've been told you have to live in Limerick. Is that true? Cork players going into the academy, you have to move to Limerick.
Yeah, but the thing is, if that would be the same in any academy. So any fella from when Tadhg Furlong was from New Ross, he didn't even ask where he had to live or anything else like that. He was so glad to get an offer to be in the academy, he probably ran up without his suitcase.
To Dublin. Yeah.
And that's what would happen in any normal circumstance. You would gravitate to the centre of excellence. And it's unlikely there'd be more than one. So whether it is Gordon Darcy, who ran up from Wexford, or some fella, Felix Jones, who went in from somewhere else and came down, that's the normal thing to do. So for a player to have the best possible chance to progress in their career, if they're deemed to be a person of future promise at international level, the best thing you could do is make their education and their development as a player as easy as possible for them. So you do that by making everything as comfortable for them in their education institute and the least travel and what they have to do so they can do their education and their training together. So in the normal circumstances, this I'm not going to, but what would normally happen is you would normally tell the player, this is the in your best interest that you play at the highest level of the game to challenge you every week and that you make your training and your education as easy as possible for you. And a huge emphasis would have been put on making sure that they had their education in check and that it would be checked out regularly with them.
Mm.
But so if my son was in the academy in the morning, I would expect him to do that and to give himself the best possible chance. He would be better off playing at the highest level and based where the centre of excellence.
So that would mean moving to UL and studying in UL and living in Limerick.
But the fella, Tony, the point I'm making is that would be normal for any university student.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you do. If you're living in Kilkenny, Waterford, what do? You move to UCD, Trinity, UCC, UL. It's not any different. That's what you do.
I know, but in fairness, Garrett, like if I'm in UCC and I'm a talent, and there are a lot of rugby talents in UCC, but I'm in UCC and the Munster Academy wants me, my point is, do I have to then transfer to UL or move to Limerick?
If you do your research, you will see that there's a load of guys in UCC have gone through the academy in the last couple of years, are currently in the academy, and everything has been done to help them by providing them with overnight accommodation in Limerick and helping them to do everything they can.
Oh, really?
And if people don't realise the number of people who are in UCC who are in the academy and have been for the last number of years, and will be in the future,
right,
based on population and based on the fact that some of the courses they want to do are not available in UL, or they might want to do them, you know, that sort of thing. So some courses just don't do. But I think the key issue here is that if you want to be a stockbroker, you give yourself every chance to be the best stockbroker you're going to be. Mm. If you want to be a rugby player, you give yourself the best chance. But we have loads of guys who travel, who are accommodated overnight. Everything has been done to accommodate them to make sure they get the best opportunity. What way they choose to avail of those opportunities will probably ultimately affect how their career develops.
Talk to me a little bit about, I was going to say, the connection between the clubs and the province, but it's almost become a disconnection now. And I'm not saying this is specific to Munster. But the club game, again, from my limited rugby knowledge, the club game in Munster always seems to be almost integral to the fabric of rugby in the province. Would you accept that? No, I know things have changed. Do you fear at all, with the growing disconnect between the club and the province, that it will become a detrimental factor going forward for Munster rugby?
First of all, I don't agree with you that there's a growing disconnect between the province. I'd say it's closer in Munster than it is in any of the other provinces.
Okay.
It's a natural thing when you get a professional team that are being dictated to by television and different things that you play at certain times and certain dates and certain places. It's going to leave the clubs without certain players on certain weekends and things like that. There's going to be clashes of fixtures. The professional game board in Munster for a number of years, I was involved in it and no longer involved in it, but John Kelly is currently chairman of it, would be huge supporters along with the team management of the guys playing as often for the club as they can. In the last 18 months, I've seen a lot of Division 1A football and some at Division 2 level. The level of rugby being played in the, what's it called now, the Energia All-Ireland League, is, in my opinion, higher than it has been for a long time. The quality of football, I frequently go down the Mar, like to see UCC playing their Division 1A. I've gone to Temple Hill. I've gone to Gary Owen twice last year. I've gone seeing games. I saw an average of about 12 or 13 Division 1A B games last year, and I couldn't only speak highly and praise the clubs and the level of rugby being played. I think that there's bound to be some disconnection, given that you're running two levels of rugby at totally different levels that are dictated. But one is the club community thing, where they feel that their best players have been taken off them.
Sure.
And that's a completely natural thing.
That happens in other codes.
I think there'll always be a bit of a perception or a bit of that. But I think there's a good connect between, like, the connection only has to be really between the first team and the team management. You don't get connection through committees and different things like that. So, like, Niall O'Donovan is a guy who is the team manager, has been involved with Shannon and at club level. He fully understands that himself, along with the academy manager, Peter Malone, who played at all levels and played for Munster and coached and everything with Gary Owen. He fully understands all of that itself. Of course, there are challenging issues when the academy medical fella says, I don't want this fella to play, and the club fella says, I think he's fine. At the end of the day, but if he's under contract to the IRFU and Munster make the call, he's their employee.
I think there's a
good connection between the top clubs. The clubs playing, whether you like it or not, and ascending, the clubs playing down along the line who don't have any players involved with Munster, I'd say they find there's a way bigger disconnect because there's no connect there. But you have the clubs at Division 1A, 1B, 2A that have players playing up along. There's a good connection. And I think that they'll be disappointed at times the players aren't available to them. But that's what you do, and that's what happens in professional sport. Munster need to keep a connection with the clubs all the time. That's where most of the younger players are coming from. There's a much wider spread of people coming out of places like Waterford. We have a lot, as you said, there's a lot of guys out of West Cork, fellas out of Bantry and things like that. And Munster need all of that because the population base is so small and there's so many people being sucked up into the greater Dublin area. It's a huge challenge for...
I mentioned the fabric, Munster fabric, and I was actually just looking last night at pictures going back to that 92 game I mentioned against Australia. You changed the crest as well, you know, the stag, what used to be the three crown. Obviously there was a commercial reality at play there, but I mean, for someone who's died in the wool Munster as yourself, like, why did you want to just change the bear, the three crests?
Well, there was two reasons, really. One is we needed something that was unique to Munster rugby. The crest that we use is a generic crest across all... It's not a sports crest, really. It's just a crest that represented, if you go way back in history, of the three crowns regarding, I think, the three kings that were in Cashel or something in that area.
That's right.
So we needed something that was unique to Munster rugby itself. And second of all, from... to pr- to protect the commercial perspective of what was going on, we had to register something to prevent people abusing the situation and making their own jerseys.
Okay.
That was a particular project that I took on myself with Claire Cook in the office, and it was something that took a long time. There was a lot of research went into it. We got a lot of help from people all over the province, got a lot of help from people unearthing the whole history side of it through the history department in Trinity College. And eventually, after many, many different, I suppose, productions, we ended up with something that everyone accepted. It was a difficult concept for the traditionalists to accept initially, but they didn't really understand the history of the other crest. When they suddenly had it sold properly to them, they realised the benefit of it.
Yeah.
It worked out really well, and it's something I think now that's accepted as the norm.
Mm. No, fair enough. I swore after we did one of these Larry Tompkins ones that we wouldn't run over. I said it was going to be an hour. Would you believe, Garrett, we're an hour and a half talking. Okay. And I'm not done.
What are we talking about for this next hour and a half?
Well, I've only a couple more things I wanted to ask you about. There's been loads of controversies. You've always dealt with controversy, in fairness, in a very, I would say, even kind of a way. The Grobler signing blew up in the last year or two. And I think, in fairness, even our own, like Donal Lenehan, who was, as you know, died in the Wool Munster, even came out and said in her own paper, look, it was a bad decision. It shouldn't have happened. Would you accept no, or would you stand defiant and say that the guy was wronged?
Well, I'd say a lot of the people that said it was a bad decision said it was a bad decision. It's very easy to say it's a bad decision, but it's all over.
Sure.
Right? That's the first thing. The second thing is the recruitment that went on around that, from my memory, and I'm just talking in a personal capacity, and I was the CEO at the time, but it wasn't any different than any other previous recruitment, in that you looked at the CV, you looked at the individual, you checked up on all the different things that had happened or not happened beforehand, and to see we getting the best possible candidate. We needed a lock at that stage. Rassi knew him exceptionally well, had worked with him previously. He had openly admitted what he'd done himself and didn't ever try to defend the thing itself.
He had a PD rap when he was younger, just for people. I'm just saying, that's what it was.
And we met him and spoke to him and everything else like that. I think he had come when his suspension was up. He came and played with Racing at the end of that year. And obviously we had a connection on Racing. No, but just to know about the individual, as you would to get a reference, not a rugby reference on him. And we were aware of it. And just like anyone, if you're sent to prison and you do your sentence, it doesn't mean you should be prevented from, like, he did his punishment for what World Rugby authorities deemed to be the appropriate punishment at the time. So the decision at the time was he the best person to fill the position that was available? And that was based on what his recruitment was about. I 100%, like, obviously no one is in favour of anyone taking substances they shouldn't be, and I wouldn't be now in the future, in the past, or I wouldn't support anyone. We would have had people in the past who did things that were wrong that they got punished for, and you have to accept those as well, and I think it'll happen in the future. I found him an exceptional young man. The whole escapade obviously has influenced his life, I would think, and the way it affected him when he came to Ireland, I think it was the previous August, it was written up, it was flagged about the difficulty he had, about the sentence that he had been imposed on him, how he'd served it, how he'd openly admitted he made a mistake, and he was wrong and all that. He did all of that. And then when it came from about to play, it broke out in the media again, and people all had different opinions on it. I think the less said about that, the better, really. I have my own opinions on certain things that were said, and I have absolutely no issue with people having very strong opinions on it. But I have, you know, I think it's how you say them and the way you say them, I think, are hugely important in people's lives. All I can say about him is that he was an exceptional young man. The whole escapade that I suppose, or the whole the way it followed up, had a huge influence on his life and affected him in a major way. We were glad to be able to help him through that thing itself, along with his family who came to Ireland on a couple of occasions. So, would you have done any different? Like, you know, you'd say to yourself, surely if you're recruiting someone in the future, the best thing you could do if that comes up is avoid all that hassle anyway, for the sake of your brand and your supporters and everything else like that. So,
yeah.
Look, when you make a decision, you do at the time what you think is the right thing to do, having done your research, spoken to references, done all the thing. At the end of the day, we're employing a rugby player to do a job and all that. And I think he was a very good rugby player. Mm. I think he would have... He if he stayed on in Ireland, I think he could have played for Ireland, as just taking his rugby ability.
Yeah.
But I think the whole thing has had quite an effect on him as an individual and his career. And I've met him once or twice since he moved to play in
Gloucester.
And so, look.
He must have been quite bitter, Garrett, about his experience, though, here, because it got quite intense for a bit.
He wasn't bitter. He wasn't. He was disappointed that that upset his rugby development, I would say.
Yeah.
He wasn't the type of fella to get bitter about things.
I mean, the only thing I would certainly concur with you on is, like, hindsight is a great selector, as we say. Like,
totally.
And I mean, at some stage, ye obviously sat down to discuss, okay, will we sign this guy? He's a very good lock. And then someone in the room had to have said, well, you know, by the way, we do have the thing about his history here.
Yeah.
And you were able to say, well, you know what? He's moved on, we all make mistakes. Would that have been a sense of what you were at?
And that's what you do in any situation. And you check, not just with him, but anyone else, you have to check out all the references, all the different things.
Mm.
You check out their disciplinary records, see if there have been issues previously. That's what you would do anyway,
yeah.
And what you'd be expected to do. And then you make a decision and you support each other on it. And
so I think what you're saying is you misjudged the reaction. I mean, is the reaction that came out a reflection on... not just Irish media, it's Irish society now, where it's, you know, if you make a mistake now, you're doomed.
Well, I think the mediums of communication give people that are now available, give uninformed people an opportunity to say things that's best saved, to say things they're not informed about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say.
Yeah. But as you say, would you accept, I suppose it's wrong of me to say it was a mistake. Because, you know, or maybe it isn't wrong of me. I mean, can I ask, was it a mistake?
But how do you, like, in that circumstance, how do you, what's your definition of a mistake in that situation?
Well, thinking of Munster.
Was it a mistake that he wasn't a good enough rugby player?
No, I'm not saying that. I know that. I know he was a good enough rugby player. I suppose, I mean, again, I suppose it's what, and I remember what Lenehan wrote afterwards, I suppose. That was, like, I think, was it Lenehan said it, or was it somebody else spoke about Munster values, whatever that means, or whatever that meant. I mean, did it compromise Munster values?
No. Everything was done correctly. People are at the centre of everything, the right people, caring for people, doing the right things for people.
Yeah.
Whether it was a mistake or not, that's for each person to decide themselves.
Mm.
But the thing was handled as professionally and as caring as it would be for any other employee of the organisation.
You were CEO for 19 years? 19 years, yeah, about 19 years.
19 and a half.
What is the biggest disappointment? And it doesn't have to be a match. It can be something that you thought was an opportunity missed, something that if... it was the road not travelled. And you can look at it now in a way, you know, in the rear view mirror, what would you change?
I would say that loss to Leinster in 2009. Because I think our team was better than the team that had won previously.
Right.
And that happens, you know. England feel the same way today. After last Saturday, you know, but I think our team was better. But on the day, Leinster got it right, and fair dues to him, and the first to congratulate him.
Mm.
But I think that,
and it changed the direction. It changed the direction.
I think that was a game we could have won. But look, you're talking here about human beings. You're not talking about machines, you know. So, but that was I felt that if we won that, we could have won another.
Yeah.
You know, that was the disappointment. But look, There's many others at lower levels and things like that as well that happened. You know, you could go back to interprovincials, you could go back to different things, but that probably would have given more continuity and given a, driven it on to another level again.
Mm.
But, you know, these things happen.
And yet we spoke about, you know, the Grobbler, and we spoke about match disappointments, Gareth, but I don't even have to presume, I know that the 16th of October 2016 was, I presume, sorry, why am I even saying presume, was the worst day of your time with Munster Rugby in a Paris hotel.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something you don't plan for. And even at the last minute or anything, you don't, it all happened so fast. It was, you know, the way you, when you're in a job and you keep thinking, when you've time to, now you would be a natural thinker, you're thinking about things, how am I going to handle this if it happens? How am I going to handle this if it happens? What if something falls out the back door of the bus? And what happens if something, how are we going to handle this, you know? Mm. But you never think of something like that. It was just like getting a shockwave that stayed with you for about 10 days, really. You know, you just had to deal with things within the shockwave you were in. I suppose the things that stick out to me about that day is about being said to me that Axel hadn't turned up for what they were doing, and that Tadhg was gone, the doc was gone to see him and all that, and then it was confirmed what the position was, and then ringing Rog just to say to him what had happened, and he said, you know what he said? He said to me, he said, Gareth's too late to the match now to be taking the piss out of people. He said, you know, he said, what are you on about, you know that?
Yeah.
And he still mentions...
He said 2 hours to the match, was it?
Yeah, two or three hours. And he still mentions that himself, I've heard him mention. So that was just something you can never plan for or never know what to do, and you've just got to deal with it on your feet at the time it happens.
Who told you, Gareth? Because I know you were obviously one of the first.
I think just Niall O'Donovan. Niall O'Donovan, I think, or George Murray was one of the, you know.
Yeah.
That was the first, you know, so it was just a surreal situation that you can't plan for. You've just got to get yourself together when it happens and see what are the priorities about what you do. So the immediate things you think of family, right? What have we got to do with family? And his dad was in Paris on the same day it happened and all that, you know. And then you've got to make sure that it's handled properly, that the wrong message doesn't get out and all that. So I suppose Fiona Murphy had a lot to do with that. Fiona was there at the time, but how you handle it, but it's... I still think about it like it's a situation you can never plan for.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. I know exactly where I was, and I was out of the country myself on the same day, and I remember getting a text on that Sunday morning, and I thought to myself, you know, no, that's no...
Yeah.
That's something, that's a message that's got garbled.
Yeah.
And I presume it must have even... The reality of it, I mean, literally, must have been so difficult to actually compute... Even though you're right there in the hotel.
You just can't compute it. You're just suddenly saying, you're suddenly getting together with people, you know, close to you and saying, what do we need to do? What do we need to do? You can't, you know. And you're walking past people in the foyer of the hotel who don't know, because you can't tell any people because the word gets out everywhere.
And your face is
and
drained.
That sort of thing, you know. But look, at the end of the day, it's all about, it wasn't about us, it was about his family and how it was handled. Luckily enough, kind of messages got transferred before it got diverted elsewhere.
Mm.
But it just flummoxed everyone for a week, really, you know.
And if you remember in the same week, and it was only, and I met Declan for a coffee, Declan Kidney for a coffee, a couple of weeks afterwards, because as I said, I had been out of the country. His wife, Anne, had passed in, I would say, only about less than a week, I'd say, Gareth, before that.
I can't remember the date.
Yeah, but I remember him saying, him being in Killaloe at the funeral.
Mm.
And it was so surreal. I remember him saying to me, like, the people were coming up actually, you know, offering their condolences to Declan. And he was actually there thinking, like, I wonder, do they know? Are they offering me condolences for Anne? Or is this actually for Axel?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing around it, and, I mean, Olive, with her dignity... You know, I always, things stick in my head and how she spoke in the church, like. And I mean, as a Munster Rugby family, and we've been talking all along about values and everything like that, looking back now, do you think that Munster Rugby did well of itself and did well by itself in how it handled such a desperate situation.
I think so. I think that particular event, a lot of things happened naturally. People did the right thing because of how they saw the whole organisation and how they saw the value and the people in it. And it was amazing the things that happened that were the right things to happen that people didn't even have to discuss. Mm. I think that demonstrated that particular day what Munster was about and the people that were about it and the supporters and everything else like that. And whether it was the involvement of their own club, his own club, Shannon, from people from Killaloe, people from everywhere and anywhere, where people came from all sides of the world, like people came from Australia, New Zealand, America, absolutely, everywhere. I suppose to finish up, that kind of demonstrates really what Munster is about.
Absolutely. I remember a picture which stands in my mind, was taken by, I know it was one of the Info Sports File lads, of Alan Gaffney just walking up the street on his own in Killaloe. And you say to yourself, like, this guy has actually got on a plane and come from Australia for Anthony Foley.
Yeah.
It was incredible stuff. Like, it was a great day in terms of values. It was a dreadful day. Let's finish on a high, or let's finish on good stuff. You've had many, many good years. It's been genuinely, Gareth, it's been a roller coaster, but it's been a fantastic sign because you have overseen the transformation of Munster from, you know, an amateur situation into this, as you say, world rugby superpower. And I know you're going to say, well, it's been 100 and 1,000 other people doing it. What's the nicest and best thing that you leave after you in terms of the betterment of Munster rugby?
I would like to think it's the people in the organisation and the people that support the organisation. You know, it was grand to say all the things I did or achieved. I didn't do any of those without the help of a whole lot of other people, whether it's coaches, staff, volunteers, different things like that. You just can't do it. It isn't as if you do all the things on your own, but what you do is you try and get people to work together. So for me, the people and the community and the local connection is what I like to see that I think we've developed, that we've got to leave behind. And it's what Munster need in the future to be successful. The guy living down the road in Clonmel or in Bantry or in Killorglin, they need to see their young fella playing in the Heineken Cup final or in the Pro 14 final. Mm. You know, that's still what keeps the team together, what keeps the province together. And I'm sure that's very evident in All-Ireland finals when the fella from, I don't know, whatever part of Tip sees the young fella who played under 14 with the crowd down the road, you know.
Yeah.
That's a hugely important thing in Munster rugby still, and it's a little thing we need to be careful of, the way modern society has gone and the way people communicate and travel and do different things, that things are things are taken for granted. But the small things that are taken for granted make a huge difference still in Irish sport and helping people be successful. Mm. And I think it's a thing that can happen any team. You know, I might be completely uninformed. You know, you can look at, even I love hurling and football and I follow all sports and I go to everything, even small things. I'm sure hurling and football with the development squads Cork have, they feel they neglected it for a bit and they're bringing it back, which is great. They've done it in other counties. The same can happen in rugby. The minute you neglect something, the way society moves so fast today, the neglect piece accelerates out of your control rapidly. Yeah,
very quickly.
Yeah. And you can lose control of something and it takes ages to get it back. So for me, is the most important thing is people need to stay grounded. They need to realise where they came from. They need to realise where the success in the province has come from. And they need to put a value on that rather than the glory parts of it. Mm. The glory parts will come.
Mm.
But I think if you keep those values, you must have values. If you don't have values, you don't have anything. And I think that Munster people, players, everyone need to make sure they stick to their values, know where the history of the team and everything came from in the province. And that will hopefully help them to win trophies. Because at the end of the day, you know, you're judged by what you win, not by what you do. Unfortunately, that's what society demands.
And you don't have any concern at all on the fact, and it's a very, very, very impressive looking management ticket, but you've Van Gran and you've Larkham and you've Rowntree and you don't have a Munster voice there. Now, you know, that's been said. Do you think that's a concern? I'm saying, speaking to what you've just talked about.
No, you've got to have the best people doing the best things, right? If you've this, like, this is professional sport at an international level, so it isn't about picking some fella from each parish in the province. It's not that,
yeah,
right? The players want the best training they can get. You may not always be able to get the best people because someone else wants them, or they can pay them more, or their family don't want to be there. Look, Niall O'Donovan is involved with the squad, and he's been there 15 or 20 years. There's loads of guys. You've had Colin McMahon in there filling in with the forwards with the academy. You've Peter Malone. There's loads of Munster fellas involved. So, you know, you can pick out small things and write on them and things like that as well, a thing like that. At the end of the day, you've got to do the best you can with what's available to you to make sure you get the best out, best results from the players on the field. And if all the fellas, key people can do that, happen to be from Italy, so what? If they all happen to be from Munster, so what? But at the end of the day, people today want results and all that. Everyone in Munster, including Johan, would tell you he'd love to have six more coaches for Munster and doing everything else, you know, but
yeah,
we got to be a bit realistic as well, you know? It isn't a coincidence that Ireland have foreign coaches. It isn't a coincidence that the Irish soccer team don't have Irish coaches, you know? So we're not any different than anyone else. And you know, if you look at what's going on in Ulster, Connacht and Leinster, is there any different, right? They have a few of each, they have a few of this, a bit of that. You know, so that's a reality of life today, and it's the same across professional sport. But look, the ideal scenario is that you'd have 23 Munster-based players every week, and that all the coaches and the fellow driving the bus, that they'd all be from down the road. But dream on, like, that's not going to happen.
Well, last question. Dream on, Munster Heineken Cup, 2008... the last success. That's going for 12 years since Munster was even in a final. How far away are Munster?
Well, the results over the last number of years have proved they're not far away, but the quality of the opposition is rising all the time. You have to admire what Saracens have done and what Leinster have done. Saracens won last year, and I think they won the year before. They won because they were the best team in Europe, full stop. They said the best players, and you can't deny that. So, Munster have been in a lot of semi-finals, but as I keep telling them, you know, there's no trophies for semi-finals, but there's teams would love to be there. Lots of semi-finals before we won it, but it's going to be way harder to win a European Cup now than it was when it was won before, because the teams are just going to be stronger. When you see what the teams in France are spending, what the teams in England are spending, and what they're doing, it's going to be way harder. But Munster won't ever be too far off it. If they get a little bit of luck, could be sometimes getting a home quarter final, getting a home semi final. That could be the difference between, it mightn't be just the teams. That's the difference sometimes. And if you look at the teams that have won it, a lot of them, they've all had those home matches. And I think that no, they have an exceptionally hard group this year with Racing and Saracens. So I wouldn't judge just on winning the European, but it is a much harder competition to win now than when Leinster won it last. It's a harder competition now.
Well, in fairness, whatever about this year, you've achieved plenty. Gareth, thanks a million.
Not at all. Yeah.